because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's summary of this week in the Capitol. J.R., the governor proposed some changes to human service and social services programs, and the response has been pretty interesting. I mean, we've seen people in wheelchairs come to the Capitol. They've come to the four budget hearings. They brought their personal care assistants. But we see some of this every time the governors, yes. governors recommend budget. Do you see more organized?
It's a little more intense this time around. It was clear in the budget hearings that two things people talked about, education and the Medicaid budget, these family care, senior care, IRIS. And part of that is the fear of change. I mean, these people are saying, we need this program to function, and if you scale it back, I can't do A, B, and C, and that's a huge concern for them.
Yeah, it is. In fact, let's take a couple minutes here and listen to one of the most emotional speakers. Amber is from Eau Claire. She has cerebral palsy, and she went to the budget hearing in Barron County. So let's listen to what she told the Finance Committee.
I have come up to see a cold.
I have trouble speaking and I have a cold.
So I'll be using my iPad to speak for me.
So I'll be using my iPad to speak for me.
My name is Amber and I'm from Eau Claire. I was valedictorian of my high school class, a graduate of UW-Stout, and Miss Wheelchair Wisconsin 2013. I'm a self-employed graphic designer for my business, Beautifully Different. In fact, the Save IRIS logo that you have seen on our t-shirts and buttons was designed by me. I am an intelligent, successful, active person in part because of programs like Family Care and IRIS. One of the greatest benefits of the IRIS program is that I get to choose, hire, and schedule the workers that care for me every day. These personal care workers provide just that, personal care. They help me do things that I am unable to do myself, like bathing, dressing, shaving, brushing my teeth and hair, feeding me, cooking, and cleaning. They also take me grocery shopping, to appointments, to my activities, and yes, sometimes even the bar. This is Wisconsin after all. To you, this may be about programs, the budget, and politics, but to me, this is my life. I did not choose to have a disability and I did not choose to need these services, but IRIS has given me choices about my quality of life. I pride myself on being as independent as I possibly can, and IRIS helps me do this. It is my hope that when reviewing the budget, this committee puts themselves not in my shoes, because most of the time I choose not to wear shoes, but in my seat, to make the choice to save IRIS.
JR, that was a very emotional mm-hmm. story. These stories are taking their toll on lawmakers, aren't they? And well, the members of the Finance Committee?
We've seen Finance come out this week. John Nygren said the governor's changes to senior care, for example, prescription drug program, are pretty much off the table.
Yeah.
Now, what off the table means is still a little bit needs to be defined, but they are getting a lot of pressure on these issues. They've made clear that education funding is going to be a big thing for them if they find new money. Other things, though, are senior care, family care, IRIS. And
right.
with the last two, one of the big questions they've asked, and Nygren's asked this week, is we need more information from the Walker administration before we decide how to move forward.
Yeah.
Every budget you see, the governor will introduce it, and lawmakers will put their imprint on it. What's unique about this one is there's been more of an imprint, if you will, or more of a kind of a cry for change early on than what we're used to seeing. Even when both parties, the one party controls all three, you know, Assembly, Senate, and governor's office, there are always changes.
Right.
This one, though, they're big, big changes. They're really kind of emotional changes at times, too, that they've kind of resonated with people. And there's also
yeah.
this kind of undercurrent of tension about the governor's pursuit of the presidency, which, let's be honest, he's running for president. Republican lawmakers feel like they're playing nice publicly that he's engaged, but they feel like he's stuck them with a very tough hand right now that they have to deal with going forward.
Well, We have a graphic here just to summarize the basic changes in these human services programs. So kind of plowing some of the same ground, but let's go over it once again. Senior care, the governor's budget would require senior care enrollees to apply for Medicare Part D.
Tried that once before.
Yeah, that didn't pass 2 years ago. Mm-hmm.
4 years ago.
2011, thank you. And we're talking here about 86,000 participants in senior care mm-hmm. who now pay $30. And Nygren is saying, well, maybe they should pay a little more because it hasn't been raised. But the administration is also saying under these changes, we wouldn't see very many fewer people on senior care. So that's just
another option that they haven't ruled out, Republicans, by the way, is saying, okay, if you're in the program, you can keep your senior care. But if you're not, you may have to go to Medicare Part D. Now, that'll be a tough sell back home of that you really saved senior care if you're cutting off future enrollees because what would happen is over time, the program would dwindle because people would pass away and go off the rolls.
Right. So, second one, family care, require DHS to seek a federal waiver to allow managed care organization to run the program statewide. Where did this idea come from? I mean, is there some large healthcare entity that wants the master contract?
Look, there are a couple of things. The number one driver right now in the budget in costs is Medicaid. How do you rein those costs in? There is a feeling like with IRIS, for example, that there is not enough of a central authority or oversight, if you will, of what the money is spent on. Like what services should be covered, what shouldn't. That woman testified in Eau Claire, right? I mean, she talked to him about being able to go to a bar. Are these things that are appropriate? You will hear those looking to rein the costs say, look, some people use them to like walk their dogs. Is that an appropriate? Now, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but that's a question they're raising. What's the appropriate use of the money? Because let's be honest, if you don't have checks on these programs, they increase dramatically. We are becoming a much, much older state very quickly.
Yes.
The more old people we have, the more folks who have this, it's going to be an explosion, if you will, down the line. How do you rein those costs in? That's the dilemma they face. They want to provide the in-home care like an IRIS because it's cheaper than putting you in a home. But how can they save money in doing that at the same time?
And this budget forced me to really get to know IRIS, which include, respect, I self-direct. I asked the Physical Bureau today, what's the number of participants in IRIS? They said 11,700. So it's not a lot of people, mm-hmm. but it's people like Amber who bring very emotional, I need this program for a quality of life to survive. And she has her own business, so she says, I need this program to be a productive member of Wisconsin society.
And when you talk to lawmakers, they will tell you that the vast majority of folks who are on the program are probably using it correctly and doing it to live the life that they can lead. There's always though that what percent is using it to, I don't know, a little bit beyond what it should be. And that's what they're trying to figure out. How do you try and identify that and rein in the cost? Because again, Medicaid budget is a huge driver of cost and it's not going to get any better unless something's changed.
And then the final change, eliminate regional, and I've got to get the term right, aging and disability resource center advisory committees. I think this is an issue where people want to feel they have a say locally.
Mm-hmm.
So these are county agencies.
And when you get the say locally, you have less control of the state to say what's good and bad or what's allowed and what not allowed in the program. And that's part of the tension, if you will, for the government right now.
But here's one kicker in this issue. If you go to the Physical Bureau summary, which you know you have, if you total up these changes and how much in state tax dollars they save, $21.59 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's pocket change in a budget of $75
it's a lot.
Billion all funds.
It's causing a lot of angst for the amount of money it was saved. But again, it's part of an overall effort of, okay, where do you find savings? Because the program is growing exponentially right now.
Yeah, it is. One in five Wisconsin residents get health care from the MA program. And I asked Fiscal Bureau, of all the increased tax collections in the next biennium, what percentage of that is going to go to pay higher MA costs? 63%.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see joint finance when push comes to shove, shelving all of the governor's proposed changes in human services?
Look at senior care first. They're going to protect senior care, but what's protect it mean? Is it going to mean fully fund it? Because remember, Assembly Republicans ran on a platform last fall of fully funding senior care. Well, what's that going to mean? Is that going to mean if you've got it, you can keep it, but everybody else has to go in the federal program?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean paying the full load? It's become like a third rail in Wisconsin politics with senior care because it is easy to apply for, it is cheap, and seniors budget for it. I talked to one lawmaker and said, look, I've talked to seniors who say, I figured I could retire because I had senior care out there that I could figure out, these are my costs, I can live that way. That's a very difficult subject. Family care, IRIS, those are very emotional topics that I think they're gonna try and find a way to tweak, but again, goes back, we've talked before, where's the money going to come from?
Yep.
And where do you direct it? Yep. If you want to put money into K-12, great.
Yeah.
The more you put there, the less you have for Medicaid. Do you move things around? That's what's going to happen is they're going to start putting the budget probably sometime in April, right? Joint finance.
Probably the second week in April.
They'll do all the low-hanging fruit first.
Yeah.
And like always happens, the end of May, there'll be these big-ticket items, K-12.
Transportation.
Medicaid. Transportation, correct. Everything will be left. The big ticket's left, and they'll figure, okay, where can we move money around to make it all balanced, and it'll be a rush right at the end.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, next subject. U.S. Supreme Court on Monday said we're not going to reconsider the Court of Appeals order that would let stand Wisconsin's photo ID law. No big surprise? Timing a surprise?
No, because if you go back to October at the time, Supreme Court stepped in the day before my birthday, I think it was, or my anniversary, one of the two, and said, okay, we're going to put on hold Wisconsin's voter ID law. They did not address the substance of the law, a challenge, all right? They just said timing. And in the dissent of the order, some of the conservative justices said, okay, we don't want to do this, but there are concerns because absentee ballots are already out,
yep,
those kinds of things. We see there's a reason why they would do this. So the time perception was, okay, it's not about the substance, it's about the timing. They don't want to change the rules so close to the election. So the fact they came down and said, we're not going to take it, is not a surprise. They've already upheld Indiana's law. It's very similar to Indiana's law, Wisconsin, so no big shock. Now, what's interesting is the state is saying, okay, look, there's no time to implement it for April 7th, so we've got 2 weeks to go. We've already got absentee ballots out. We've already got people voting in person absentee.
Yeah.
We can't do this for April 7th, but after that, it'll be in effect. So we're going to have a couple of special elections at local level in May.
Yes.
If Paul
School
Farrell,
district referendums, I think.
If Paul Farrell wins that county executive seat,
April 7th,
he will likely step down from a Senate seat sometime this summer after the budget.
Right.
There'll be a special election there. They'll have some trial runs, if you will, with voter ID. Then we have 2016, some big ticket races. We're going to have a Supreme Court race, most likely. Justice Crooks would
seat.
Be up. Might he retire? We think he is.
My turn. Presidential primary, April 5th.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Primary in August, and then a general election in November will plead 3 million people. That'll be the real test for voter ID in Wisconsin. How do they implement it? How does it go?
Okay.
Is a public affairs campaign good? Will they do one? Kevin Kenney says a week so late. We did an ad campaign. We had it in the can ready to go and put on hold because of the court decisions. We want money, lawmakers. If you want to get this campaign out there again, we need money to go out there and do it to inform voters.
PR marketing.
But there will be a slow buildup that, you know, the February election next year will be the first statewide one with voter ID in place since 2012.
Yeah.
That'll be a trial run. You can slowly ramp it up a little bit, if you will.
Well, let's just take a look at what the Attorney General's immediate response was. The voter ID law will be in place for future elections. This decision is final. We interviewed Kevin Kennedy on this yesterday, so let's take just a few seconds and listen to what he said on this very issue. Well, that's my first question. Is that final, or can groups like the ACLU, which immediately put out a press release saying, you know, we're going to try to throw a Hail Mary pass, is that final definite, Finney?
I can't envision a scenario where photo ID would be in place for the April 7th election. We defer to the Attorney General's office and how they'd handle it. We had talked. We had an understanding from our conversations. They agreed with us that it could not be enforced before the election, given the timing, the fact that absentee ballots were already out in the hands of people requesting them by mail.
Okay.
We did get their backing that's right, that we could not effectively enforce this, and so we should move forward without it.
You know what strikes me, JR, is when Kevin Kennedy says not for the April 7 election, but everything after that going forth. This law was passed in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
It's been in place, out of place, in place for one spring referendum. Do you think voters are like, we don't know who to believe and whether it's going to be out there or not?
There is some confusion, which might help the GAB's cause, if you will, for doing a public awareness campaign. Now, one thing Kennedy said was with these special elections coming up, they're very small universes of voters.
Yes.
You can easily target a message, if you will, to the local clerks to kind of help them. But, you know, most voters already have a state ID, so that won't be a big impact for them. The question is those 300,000 that don't. You know, I've talked to Democratic Party officials before about this issue. They said, look, we can figure out a way to live in a voter ID world. We don't like it, but what's going to happen is the effort we put in before to turning out voters, to identify them and get them to polls, we now have to put that effort into, do you have an ID? You don't have one, let's help you get your documents, let's help you get the ID, then get you to the polls. It makes it more difficult for them to turn out their voters because, let's face it, the people who don't have an ID tend to vote Democratic.
Well, do you think having to show a photo ID to vote in the April 5 presidential primary, Any theories on whether that will help or hurt our candidate for president, Governor Scott Walker? Who knows,
question.
Huh?
I mean, it's always a question of, okay, those who don't have an ID, how many of them vote? You know, that's another thing. It's hard to say exactly what the impact will be. Now, what I'm getting interested to watch is next November. We had roughly 3 million people turn out in 12 and 8 in Wisconsin for presidential elections. What if the number is 2.5 in 16? Mm-hmm. What's that mean? And what if it's 3 million? Hey, that means there was no real impact, right? So that's going to be kind of a thing to watch. Is does it do anything for turnout? Do we see any change
right.
how many people vote? And the presidential is the big game in Wisconsin every 4 years. That will be a good cast to see how
But the takeaway on this issue, photo ID is here to stay.
Unless
beginning April 8th. No, I'm not going to go there. Because those are Hail Mary passes, and nobody thinks they're going to succeed. Okay, new subject. But while we're talking about Kevin Kennedy, last week he goes before a legislative committee on the issue of campaign finance, and he says, the quote is, our current campaign finance laws, because of the recent federal and state court decisions, wholly irrelevant.
Yes.
And then yesterday I had him in for a follow-up interview, and he said, yes, but the 1974 limits, you and I can't donate more than $10,000 to any candidate for statewide office, and the prohibition on corporate donations are still in place.
Mm-hmm.
JR, is that right? I mean, are there any limits now? It seems to
yes.
me that the stream of federal and state rulings have wiped out our campaign finance limit on donations. Do I have it wrong?
Well, it's clear that everybody that I looked at their reports, they are still sticking to the $10,000.
Bradley says she's sticking to it. Daly's sticking to it.
So everybody's sticking to those limits. Those seem to be in place. The question kind of is becoming, what are you going to do to rewrite campaign finance laws? Now, Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, I've spoken to before about this topic. He wants to undertake an effort to rewrite them. He believes the limits are low. They were set 30-some years ago.
1974,
40
the wake
years
of the
ago.
Watergate scandal.
Okay. Haven't been raised since then.
Right.
So they should be increased. He believes corporate contributions should be allowed to the parties, but not to candidates. His argument is that unions can give to parties, so why can't corporations make it a level playing field, if you will? And he argues for disclosure. Now, disclosure is not going to be for these third parties that run the issue ads that say, Steve Walters is a jerk, calls you all say that he stinks, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There won't be disclosure for those guys. It will be, though, an effort to have you report your contributions. The idea being, if there is sunlight, that's the biggest disinfectant, right?
Right.
Here's a caveat to that, though. During this hearing on earlier this week about the campaign finance laws, two lawmakers said, well, we have concerns about listing your employment information, for
yes.
example.
And what should be the threshold if you give above X? You should have to disclose where you work.
Excuse yes, because they're saying at $100, which is now, it's unfair because these people are, you know, their businesses are targeted. They will say, okay, you're for so-and-so, I don't like this. Their employers say, hey, wait a second, I'm getting caught up in this stuff because your employment is listed. The flip side is, you know, Kevin Kennedy argued that those are important information because then you know who's backing the candidate. It helps you give a fuller picture, if you will,
yes.
of who supports this person and what their beliefs may be. So that's going to be interesting to watch what they do with that going forward. I mean, I'm going to be honest. I love the requirement because it gives me great stuff to report about.
Yeah.
I can't say whether it's a good or bad thing other than that, but it is something that we look for when we look through campaign finance reports. Well, who do you work for? What's your interest?
Okay, but JR, two follow-up questions. We didn't know, going through any state records, that Gogebic gave $700,000 to Governor Walker's recall and the GOP recall efforts. Those weren't disclosed in state forms. And the Yahoo News story this week that John Menard gave $1.5 million to the governor and those supporting him, those weren't disclosed on state forms. So you have this huge amount of secrecy out there. Now, I don't know whether the Yahoo story is true or not. You do this full time. Do you believe it?
I have nothing to doubt it. I mean, we saw a lot of John Doe documents last summer that gave us indication of where some money was coming from.
Right.
I didn't see a $1.5 million donation from John Menard, but I only saw what was released publicly one time on accident after the court system. So, I mean, there could be many, many more pages out there that could have much, much more than what I've seen personally. So I can't speak to the donation itself.
Okay, but let's bring it back this way. You and I know that Senator Fitzgerald, Assembly Speaker Voss, want to do away with GAB.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I are hearing that, you know, they're talking about what could be a final draft of that bill. Are they, given the focus on doing away with GAB, Are they going to have time to deal in the tremendously complex issue of campaign finance and new limits and updating our campaign finance laws, which date to 1974?
Oh, excellent question, because there's what's going on right now, the budget. The budget's going to suck all up the oxygen starting in April and May. I think Mary Lozzi was on your show not that long ago saying that a good time to take up a ban on abortion for 20 weeks would be around now.
Yes.
That could be a huge fight. I mean, there are some big ticket items like John Doe changes.
Yep.
They want to talk about those. That might be held on now after the Supreme Court weighs in. There are some big ticket items to be dealt with. Will they deal with them this summer? Good question. The budget, though, that's the driver of everything starting in April and May. So yeah. I don't know if there's enough oxygen, if you will, for those big debates right now.
Last question on this issue. Given the uncertainty, does this uncertainty favor the GOP more than Democrats? And if so, why would the Republicans want to change a system that favors them more than their opposition?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, let's take one example, all right? Before, you had a $10,000 per year limit for donors, right? So yes, you give a
total
max of $10,000 per candidate for a cycle, but each year, $10,000 max. Now, there was no cap on donations to political parties, but because of this other donation cap over here of $10,000 a year, it acted like a cap on party donations because you're likely to give the candidate in the party, right?
You could tell all these fundraisers, hey, I'm maxed out.
Yeah. But now that cap has gone away on $10,000 per year, parties can take unlimited amounts of money, and that's why you see things like Sheldon Adelson giving the state GOP $650,000 last October to help the effort with Scott Walker. I went through the GOP and the State Democratic Party of Wisconsin's reports, if you will, to see, okay, who benefited the most from that change. The GOP definitely had an edge, from what I could tell. Now, you can make all kinds of reasons why. Is it because they have deeper pocketed donors for that? Because the Dems relied more on union money in the past, and unions have been decimated by Act 10? I mean, there are a lot of moving parts in this. But it is clear that, at least in that one avenue, Republicans benefited compared to Democrats. Now, what Robin Voss is talking about, corporate contributions, if you allow those to parties, those secret groups, if you will,
yes,
there may be more money that would flow to the party than those secret groups. You'd have a more controlled message, if you will, if you are candidates and part of the party. So that might be a change they would want, but it's still a kind of a big question of what are they going to pull out and do? It's a complex issue. You could go really, really simple with campaign finance.
And one thing I've learned covering the Capitol for a long time is that every legislator thinks she or he is an expert on campaign finance law.
And don't forget, the Assembly actually passed a bill last session that threw some bones to Democrats to try and make them okay with it.
I forgot.
It passed
that
on a voice vote.
Thank you.
But include things like being able to register online, for example, to vote. Now, I don't know if Republicans would do that again, but they also may want to do a bipartisan bill to have some cover, if you will, or agreement on what they do.
Right. Okay, thanks. Next subject. I was surprised. Maybe I surprised easy. Ray Cross said, if I can't significantly cut the two-year $300 million cut in aid to the UW system, I will resign. He ought to... What was your reaction? Were you as surprised as me?
One of the things I kind of wondered was, does he already know the answer to that question? Because you don't. What's the old line? You don't let your mouth write checks your body can't cash, right? I mean, would you make a promise like that if you didn't really know or were confident in the answer? I wouldn't, but that's a good question.
Well, let's. Joint Finance is not going to give the governor his
authority.
Mm-hmm. That's gone. They're going to tear up the governor's plan on human services. And now Ray Cross says, you know, he may have the shortest tenure. He was just appointed in January of 2014 of any UW president. What do you think is his definition of significant?
Good question. That is an easy word to dance around, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what I think is clear from talking to people in the Capitol is that some Republicans want to reduce $300 million.
Yes.
They are okay with that. Now, might they reduce the $300 million but require them to use the reserves to backfill that $300 million? Might they say, okay, you can raise tuition? There are all kinds of possibilities out there, if you will, to reduce the $300 million.
Well, just a P.S. Ray Cross, when he was asked that, would you resign if you can't blunt this $300 million cut? He's one word, yes. He could have said, I will consider resigning. So he's put himself in a pretty unusual spot. Agree?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing. There is a little bit of sentiment that Ray Cross is in a no-win situation, okay? Because on the one hand, Republicans have had no relationship with the university system for a long time, at least the administration.
Yep.
Last couple ones have had bad relationships with Republicans, right?
Yes.
So Ray Kross came in and actually made an effort to go open doors with Republicans, all right? In doing so, did he get a good deal in this budget? Well, he got $3 million cut, but he got public authority, so maybe. You could argue, if you're a Ray Kross fan, that, oh, by the way, Republicans talking about lowering the cut wouldn't be doing that without the efforts, the foundation he built the last few months doing these talks. If you're a Democrat, you say, look, you're never going to get what you want from Republicans. You should be a vocal critic of everything they do to try and cut the university system. Otherwise, you're not doing your job.
Right.
Again, a no-win situation. And then you have a faculty that's saying, we're not happy. You're not on our side. I mean, it was really an interesting tone in that meeting with the UW-Milwaukee faculty where they're saying, prove to us that you are fighting for us.
Or a champion.
And I'm sure you want to go.
Or advocate.
That's what I've been doing for the last few months, talking to all these guys by the time up at the Capitol, the other side of State Street. So, again, in a no-win situation in some ways.
And I love this segment of the show because you keep track of our presidential candidate governor to an extent that I can't. And all I can do is ask you questions. Has he had a good week? Well, right now, he's on the Texas-Mexico border with the governor of Texas, correct?
Yes. I saw a picture that Greg Abbott tweeted a few hours ago that had him and Governor Walker by a helicopter, so down there touring the border. Showing him about how the federal government has not secured the border, I think was Abbott's tweet, something like that.
Okay, and then he was in Phoenix.
Arizona on Wednesday for a speech to like a business group behind closed doors, from what I can see, with no media coverage of it, I could tell.
And he picked up somebody that really helped Romney?
Yes, from a Romney aide assignment. He continues to build the team, if you will. And then there's again another controversy about, well, did Governor Walker flip-flop? Now what's interesting is, the Wall Street Journal, and again, a lot of this has been done national media with these kind of sources, if you will, within Republican circles.
Yep.
Wall Street Journal is saying that Governor Walker had a private dinner in which he backed a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. Now, that would be a...
After going on Fox News on a Sunday and saying, I've changed my mind, no amnesty? Excuse me.
And remember...
This is your issue. I'm going to stay out of your way.
Remember, before he said, I don't back amnesty, and people said, well, wait a second. Here's 06 and before when you said you did, and now he's saying, okay, I changed my mind because the president has so botched the issue. And then he goes to this dinner, and the Wall Street Journal says, well, three sources tell us that he backed a path to citizenship.
Walked it back.
But then his campaign said, well, not a campaign yet, it's a 527, says he has not changed position. And now the dispute is that Governor Walker said that he supported a legal status, but not citizenship. So what's that mean? But this is... Again, we've talked this before with Governor Walker, where he is trying to thread a needle, if you will, on these issues.
Yep.
I mean, look in Iowa, the renewable fuel standard, ethanol. That's a big, big issue for Iowa farmers, corn farmers, right? But for conservatives, it is just something they detest because it is a federal mandate. And Governor Walker said, I support keeping it for now, but I want to phase it out because it's an access issue. Never used the word phase out, though. He just said, we'll keep it for now, but it's an access, there's a market issue. So he's, again, doing this kind of dance, and it's hurting his image in some ways with certain national Republicans of, okay, is this guy really, truly take no prisoners, I'm unintimidated, like his book said, by anybody, or is this a guy who is pandering to audience depending on who he talks to? It is part of the growing process for Governor Walker on the trail. The danger for him, again, is if at some point people go, okay, wait a second, you're not as authentic as we thought you were, that would totally undercut his entire image and argue for the presidency.
I think you just said he had what, a C-plus week on the presidential trail this
week?
Well,
what's interesting is it's been the same story now for 2 or 3 weeks.
I know.
Nothing has really changed. It's, okay, he said this, but against this, you know.
I understand.
It's been kind of a treading water, if you will, time. In the polls you see, every poll that I've seen at last couple of weeks is have Governor Walker and Jeb Bush tied 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. Tied 1 and 2 or... reversed. And what's interesting is each of those polls shows that the conservative, self-identified conservative voters back Walker over Bush by a big margin. The moderates back Bush over Walker by a big margin. But there are more conservatives who will vote in the primaries than there are moderates.
That's so true. That's true.
It's fascinating. Everybody else is kind of like over here. It's Jeb and Scott over here.
Yep. Okay. Time for Wiz Politics stock report rising.
Senior care. So a big boost to the program to, you know, avoid, at least for now, you know, the possibility of going away and becoming Medicare Part D. Again, that question we talked about before, what does saving it mean? Will saving it mean cutting off new enrollees but keeping those who are there? Will saving it mean funding it as it is? Will saving it mean keeping it but raising the premium? copay? I mean, those are all issues to be determined. And again, it goes back to the money. Where's the money going to come from? How much will there be? And what are the priorities for these lawmakers when it comes crunch time in May?
Mixed.
Ray Cross, I mean, again, the no-win situation.
Ray, I might fall on my sword, Cross. Go ahead.
You know, it's the no-win situation. He is getting criticized by all sides for the approach he's taking, but he may have taken the best path he could, if you will. And when you talk to fans, they'll say, look, he had to build relationships with Republicans because they run the show. And if you look at the maps that they drew in 2011, they're going to run the show for a while. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a relationship with them, you're going to be in a bad situation going forward. So he did the best he could, build a relationship. Republicans are going, okay, that's great, Ray, but your Board of Regents back there that we thought was Governor Walker appointees have all gone native, are all talking about we got to protect tenure, got to protect this.
Governance.
We need to see changes to be happy with giving you authority. You're not ready for it.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like in a man with lots of shots from all sides and a few people behind him right now.
I understand why he's mixed. And falling?
The Bucks, the governor's proposal to do a $220 million,
yep.
That was already dead. This LFB memo this week that said it could cost $488 million to pay it back basically buried the coffin, if you will. What's interesting is the Bucks story, much like Governor Walker's, it's been the same for 3 weeks now, if not longer. The owners aren't giving us any answers about the price tag, the design, the site. They've indicated what their preference is, but there's no concrete, here's our plan on the table right now. Republicans are going, okay, I need a plan. I need the city to pitch in and the county to pitch in, and then I can figure out how much we can stomach because, oh, by the way, these outside Republicans, they're not happy about giving anything the Bucks right now.
No. They really.
Then you have these other lawmakers saying, okay, we can't embarrass the governor. He has put a plan in the budget to help fund a Bucks arena. We can do a smaller number or find a new method. What's that new method going to be? So Scott Fitzgerald, Senator Majority, is out there in kind of the background working on some new approach.
I hear it could involve a loan. Have you heard that?
There are all kinds of theories right now what it could be.
Right.
But it's meant to either lower or eliminate bonding in the plan and lower the cost of the state.
Okay.
Now, also, there's this tension of, okay, owners, you guys are pretty wealthy. And, yeah, great, you've pitched in 150. That's great. But can't you pitch in a little bit more?
And they've said no. Right.
Now, here's this other kind of interesting thing. If you are an owner of the Bucks, these guys are not dumb people at all. They are fairly intelligent, made a lot of money.
Hedge fund, yes.
Do you think they bought the Bucks to turn a dollar or as a status symbol because they are part of this elite class of NBA? So would they really, truly, in the end, say, no, I can't do this and walk away? Because they will get a $25 million payout no matter what.
The NBA will have to buy the team, correct?
Buy the team.
If there's no arena by 2017.
Move them, and they get a profit.
Okay.
There's that question out there. And, oh, by the way, owners – who made a lot of money by doing a lot of smart things, if you do the state authority that Governor Walker proposes, that state authority runs the new arena. That means they have control over the revenue, and so you have to kind of ask them for. It's a lot of headache. There are all these moving parts, and there's no clear answer yet. I do get the impression in the end there will be something, but what it is and will make the Bucks happy, I have no idea
right now.
And
I completely understand why you listed as falling. let's end it on this note. Running a state Senate committee, mm-hmm. Senator Van Wongard announced that the subject of the committee was if you're a retired police officer, you should be able to carry a concealed weapon into schools and some other mm-hmm. buildings. So he announces that at that moment he's packing. I don't know what type of weapon on his hip, which made me go back to DOJ and say, how many CCW permits have been issued since they've been legal? What's your guess?
A couple hundred thousand.
245,000. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And JR, I'm not packing, are you?
Just my personality, Steve.
I understand. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind for March 27th.